Chapter 18. Kate had never been to Cabbage Town before, which she gathered was not to be confused with the pejoratively designated CT of Colored Town. The southeastern section of the city was literally on the other side of the railroad tracks. She couldn't recommend the place. The area was blighted by abandoned houses and factories that had fallen into disrepair. She assumed the usual culprits were to blame: the oil crisis, high unemployment, and the worst stock market crash since the Great Depression. Public services seemed to stop at the tracks. Garbage cans were overflowing. Potholes pocked the streets. This seemed like the sort of tough area where the Lawsons would live. The people of the South Side were on their own. Through her rolled-down window, Kate took in a large red-brick warehouse with crumbled smokestacks reaching to the sky. The painted letters on the side were faded. She made out the word National and wondered if this was the pencil factory where Leo Frank had worked. 60 years ago, the Jewish industrialist had been wrongfully convicted of murdering a young girl. A lynch mob had kidnapped Frank from prison and strung him from a tree. Photos were taken showing his stretched neck. Pieces of Frank's clothing were sold as souvenirs. Among the mob were a former governor, a retired superior court judge, and several police officers. They were never tried for his murder, and likely pleased with what followed. Roughly 3,000 Jews pulled up stakes and fled the state. Kate had heard about Frank as a child. His story was one of those, "This is how they tried to kill us, this is how we survived," lessons they taught at the temple. Kate couldn't recall, but Philip Van Zandt was probably in the class too. He was in all of her classes before he moved away. Until that spin-the-bottle game, she had never given him a second thought. He was just one of those awkward, pimply boys who lurked in corners. And he could continue to lurk, because Kate hadn't completely lost her mind. She had to assume that last night was the result of some kind of temporary insanity. She'd been tired, her ego was bruised, her defenses were down. Kate was the daughter of a psychiatrist. She had read her share of Freud. There was no better word to describe what she'd allowed to happen in the kitchen than adolescent. She was a grown woman, a widow. Philip had a wife. He was going to give her children. He had made it crystal clear that Kate was only good for one thing. And as far as Kate was concerned, Philip Van Zandt could go knock on his own damn door. The car's tires thrummed against the bridge spanning I-20. Kate looked down at the light traffic on the freeway. Women, mostly. At this time of day, they were either heading to the grocery store or going home after having dropped their kids at school. Maggie spoke for the first time since they'd left the building. East-west highways get even numbers. North-south ones get odd numbers. Kate had no idea what she was talking about, but she nodded anyway. Auxiliary interstates get 3 digits. The first digit is even if it's circumferential, odd if it's a spur. If the number is divisible by 5, that means it's a major artery.
How fascinating.
You need to know this stuff, Kate. What if you're pursuing a suspect and he gets on the highway?
Kate stared longingly out the window. The car was going too fast for her to safely jump out.
Do you know your radio codes?
Kate sighed as loudly as she could. Code 24, demented person. Code 28, drunken person. Code 30, driving under the influence. Code 49, rape. 50, shooting. 51, stabbing. 63, okay. Maggie turned onto a side street. Kate noticed that the houses had changed. They were grander, or at least they had been, at some point in the distant past. A few Victorians, a handful of Queen Anne's, and a lot of little craftsman bungalows lined the broad streets. Kate asked, "What's this area called?"
"Grant Park." Kate had been here once before. She was on a class field trip to visit the Atlanta Zoo, which was one of the most depressing things she had ever seen in her life.
The animals lived in filth. There was a gorilla who sat alone in a concrete cage and watched soap operas all day. Looking out the car window, Kate didn't see that the neighbors had it any better. The blight from Cabbage Town extended into Grant Park. Windows were boarded over, yards were overgrown jungles. Cars were up on cinder blocks. Maggie said, "Just like Buckhead, right?" Kate didn't trust her ability to filter sarcasm. The car slowed. Maggie pulled into the opposite lane, then glided to a stop in front of a rambling Victorian. Kate smiled. The old house reminded her of a dollhouse her father had bought her. The siding was light blue, the trim was crisp white with black edging around the windows. All the scrolls and cupolas were accented in a darker blue. There was a wraparound porch and a Juliet balcony over a grand porte cochere.
"It's beautiful."
"Yeah," Maggie agreed. "Too bad I live in the piece of shit next to it." She pushed open the door. "Stay in the car." Kate was glad to have permission. She watched Maggie walk toward the neighboring house. The most generous thought she had was that the Victorian had good bones. Everything went downhill from there. The large turret bubbled out like a growth. Plastic covered most of the windows. Paint peeled from every piece of wood. Broken stones crumbled from the foundation. An ugly metal carport that belonged on an airstream spanned the bottom of the driveway. Kate heard a screen door open and bang close. A lanky man in a tracksuit came out of the nicer house. Kate guessed he was around her age. He wore a headband and white sneakers. He stopped at the bottom of the stairs and stretched back and forth. She supposed he was a jogger. Kate saw scores of them around the park these days. There was something on a chain around his neck that she couldn't make out. He kept glancing over his shoulder at the Lawson house. Kate couldn't tell if he was nervous or looking for someone.
"Hey, asshole!"
Jimmy yelled. She assumed he was talking to the neighbor. He limped across the front porch. His injured arm was stiff at his side.
"Mind your own goddamn business."
The neighbor did a very good job of turning a deaf ear. He sprinted up the driveway. His arms were bent at the elbow, which Kate understood was an excellent way to run.
"Murphy!" Jimmy was talking to Kate now. "Help Rick."
Kate had no idea who Rick was, but she got out of the car. Delroy and Watson would not have approved. Kate had been so distracted by what was going on in front of her that she'd forgotten to look behind. There was another Atlanta police cruiser parked on the street. A uniformed man was opening the back door. He was tall, with a thick mustache and hair as black as the leather gloves on his hands. She saw at least 5 file boxes inside the car.
"Rick Anderson," the officer told Kate,
and she realized that he was the only cop since Maggie who'd bothered to introduce himself. Even more surprisingly, he shook her hand.
"Kate Murphy. Very nice to meet you, Mr. Anderson."
He seemed embarrassed.
"Everybody calls me Rick." "Get the boxes."
Maggie had sneaked up on both of them. She looked as angry as she sounded. "We're going to do it here." Kate didn't bother to ask for details that would never come. She held out her arms and took a box. Maggie took 2, and Rick grabbed the remaining ones, plus 2 bags marked evidence. Rick said,
"You're looking nice today, Maggie."
Maggie asked, "Is this everything?"
"Everything I could find."
Maggie told Jimmy, "I thought we were doing this at the diner."
"We're here. Why would we go somewhere else?"
Maggie was already on the front porch. She stopped before going in. Kate saw her eyes follow the jogger as he ran up the street. Jimmy demanded,
"What are you looking at?"
"My dick of a brother." Maggie disappeared inside. Kate couldn't begin to decipher the exchange. She stepped gingerly up the stairs.
All she needed was to fall through one of the rotten treads. Rick was more trusting. He bounded up, two at a time, then stopped in front of the door so Kate could precede him. Cigarette smoke wafted out of the house like a genie's hand beckoning them indoors. Kate looked down at her feet as she tried to acclimate. Her eyes started to water. Her throat was burning. And then she looked up because she'd met her limit today for almost running into things. The word depressing came to mind as Kate took in the interior of the house. Everything was painted dark gray, from the walls to the ceiling to the trim. The wooden floors were in disrepair. The fixtures were little more than bare bulbs. The decor was right out of All in the Family. Yellow and orange flowered couch, ugly reclining chairs, a cigarette-scarred coffee table.
God damn, lady.
Jimmy was standing in the foyer. His eyes went to Kate's chest.
Did you have them knockers yesterday?
Kate lifted the box higher. She blushed, but not for the reason everyone was obviously thinking. She couldn't look at Jimmy without thinking about the x-ray Philip had shown her. In here. Maggie sat at the dining room table. Even with the large floor-to-ceiling windows, the place had the feeling of a tomb. She stated the obvious. The light's shitty and the windows are painted shut. Kate tried to think of something positive. Your anaglypta's in beautiful condition. They all stared at her. She played back her words in her mind and figured she deserved it. The wallpaper. She nodded toward the embossed paper on the walls. Jimmy said, my dad painted over it. You're supposed to. Kate felt the heat of their scrutiny. I'll just be quiet.
My favorite words from a woman.
Jimmy limped around the table. He was wearing black pants and a white button-down shirt. The sleeves were rolled up. The open collar had shorter points than was the fashion. Kate had never met a gay man who wasn't a stylish dresser. She wondered if Philip was being truthful. He certainly enjoyed shocking her. But then, why would he lie about something like that? Sit. Maggie pointed at the chair across the table. She had a file open in front of her. A yellow legal notepad and pen were at her elbow. Kate saw that Maggie's belt was hanging on the back of the chair. She took off her own belt and did the same. The sensation of weightlessness was recherché, which thought she kept to herself.
Keep your mic plugged in, Maggie mumbled. Her head was bent over a file.
Kate put the transmitter in her lap as she sat down. Both Rick and Maggie had the volume low on their radios. The crackling noise had become so constant that Kate barely registered it anymore. Rick took off his gloves. Maggie has Ballard and Johnson. You take Keenan Porter. Kate reached for the file Maggie offered, though she had no idea what was expected of her. Jimmy said, just write down anything that seems weird. Excellent. Kate was still clueless, but she felt it was better to agree. Maggie slid another legal pad across the table. Kate took the pen out of her pocket. She supposed she could doodle until someone asked her why the hell she wasn't doing what she was supposed to be doing. We'll split along with the girls. Rick tossed folders in front of Jimmy as he spoke. K&P evidence log, duty sheet, dispatch calls. He scooped the rest of the folders out and held them. I've got B&J. Jimmy chuckled.
I could use a BJ.
Maggie glowered at her brother.
Shut up, Jimmy.
Kate felt her cheeks flush. She didn't know what to do but open the file in front of her. Her stomach churned at the photograph. An 8x10 color close-up of a dead man. At least, she assumed he was dead. His eyes were open. His graying black hair parted like a curtain across his forehead. In the center was an almost perfectly round hole. Jimmy nudged her arm.
You never see a dead man before?
Of course she has.
Maggie sounded livid. Jesus.
Jesus yourself, gal.
Jimmy leaned his chair back on two legs.
What's gotten into you?
We were supposed to do this at the diner.
So?
He bounced in his chair as he threw a pen at his sister. Kate turned to the next picture. Another man. Another bullet hole. The photos they had been shown at the academy were black and white. Some of them were photocopies. They were nothing like the Kodachrome she held in her hands.
That's Porter? Maggie asked Kate.
Kate turned the photo over. Porter, Marcus Paul. The name was familiar, but she couldn't place it. Still, she told Maggie, yes, Porter. When was he killed? Kate had to give herself time to process the question before she figured out how to answer it. Bad photocopies or not, she'd read a police report before. She flipped past the photographs and found the incident report.
September 12th.
2 days before the anniversary of Patrick's death. That was enough to jog her memory. Two police officers had been murdered execution style behind a department store on September 12th. Kate scanned the names on the boxes. Mark Porter, Greg Keane, Alex Ballard, Leonard Johnson. Now she remembered. She'd read about all the men in the newspaper. They were reviewing the files of dead police officers. Maggie clicked her pen. She wrote as she talked. Ballard and Johnson were killed, what was that, 3 weeks before? Kate picked up her pen and followed Maggie's lead, making note of the victims' names and the dates of their deaths. She flipped to the coroner's report. Both died from gunshot wounds to the head. Start with the incident report. Maggie made a column, so Kate made a column. What solves a crime is the connections. How is the victim connected to the killer? Kate wrote Porter at the top of one column and Keane at the next. There's no such thing as coincidence. Maggie tapped her fingers for emphasis. If anything sticks out, then write it down. It doesn't matter how stupid it sounds. Let us know.
Yeah, Jimmy said. Don't worry about looking bad.
Kate glared at him. He was sitting so close that she could feel the heat from his body. She didn't understand this man. Regardless of the secret he was hiding, Jimmy had been shot yesterday. 24 hours before that, a man who was likely his lover had been murdered in front of him. The same murderer had tried to kill Jimmy. How could he sit there so casually making jokes?
Rick asked, "You got any beer?"
Jimmy stood up. He rested his hand on the back of Kate's chair, then the wall, as he limped into the other room. The clock by the door showed it was just after 9 in the morning, which had absolutely nothing to do with Kate. She glanced through the personnel files. Just the basics, date of employment, previous experience, marital status. There were no witness statements, but she found a few notes taken during interviews with family members and friends. Maggie said, "You always have to start over with him." She was talking about Jimmy. Her tone had an air of resignation. No matter what you do the day before, no matter how much you prove yourself, he hits reset the next day.
Like an amnesiac, Rick said.
They both looked at him.
Like when you hit your head.
Rick stood up.
I'll go check on Jimmy.
Kate waited until he was gone.
Can you please tell me what we're doing here?
We weren't supposed to do it here.
As usual, Kate was slow on the uptake. Maggie was embarrassed about her house, and for good reason. Rather than make it worse by offering false platitudes, Kate asked, "What are we looking for in these files?" Maggie sat back in her chair. She tapped her pen on the table as she studied Kate. "I think the Atlanta shooter is the same guy who murdered Don Wesley and tried to kill Jimmy." She stopped tapping her pen.
and Jimmy agreed with me last night, but today he thinks I'm an idiot.
Kate had to make some leaps to understand what she was saying.
The shooter killed these men,
Porter and Keene and Ballard and Johnson?
The M.O.s are identical.
Maggie paused.
An M.O. is...
Modus operandi, yes, I know. They were all killed in the same manner.
Right, so we need to study the details of both sets of cases. Then we can compare them to what happened to Jimmy and Dawn. At least, what Jimmy is saying happened.
Kate prayed that her expression didn't give her away. She had a better idea about what happened in that alley than Maggie did.
Well, Dawn was shot twice, correct? And these other men were just shot one time.
Correct, Maggie agreed. But there are lots of divergent facts. Neither Porter nor Keene were ever partnered with Johnson or Ballard. They were all in the same zone, but they didn't socialize. Detectives who are smarter than us have already combed through these files and they didn't find anything that connected any of the victims.
Why do they need to connect?
Because. She searched for an explanation. Let's say that all the victims were Vietnam vets.
My two guys were.
My two guys weren't. But if they were, then maybe they were part of a veterans group, or they met at the VA hospital or served together.
Maggie shrugged. If we find out how they all knew each other, then chances are they all knew somebody else.
You mean the killer?
Kate finally got it. And now she understood why Maggie kept asking about the bar where Dawn Wesley had gotten those matches.
Or if they all hung out at the same place, like a bar, then that would be a connection?
Exactly. But if that place from the matchbook was a cop hangout, more people would know about it.
That's the first time you've told me I'm right about something.
Kate didn't let Maggie spoil the moment.
Can't you just call the phone company and get the address?
It doesn't work that way. There's not a central number to call. You have to file a formal request, and Salmeri's Yellow Pages is a month old. Same as mine. If the bar had been open when these other guys were murdered, then it would be in the book.
Kate nodded.
Fair point.
So we are going through these files to connect these four shootings to Dawn Wesley's death.
Right, Maggie agreed. Sometimes with two cases, it's hard to spot the connections. If you throw in a third case, your odds get better. Only, we need to prove that the third case belongs.
And we do that by finding the connection that ties them all together.
Right. Do you read?
Of course I read.
I mean books, stories.
Yes.
She tapped the file in front of her. Look at it like a thriller novel. Michael Crichton, Helen McGinnis, whatever, it's a story and we have to figure out the ending before anybody else does.
Jacqueline Suzanne was more Kate's speed, but she got it.
Okay.
Good.
That was obviously the end of the lesson. Maggie leaned over the pages in front of her. Kate flipped back to the incident report. Whoever had done the typing relied entirely on police codes. Thankfully, Kate hadn't just been showing off before. She had memorized all the signals and APCO codes from her textbooks. She turned to a fresh sheet of paper and translated the timeline. At approximately 3:15 a.m. on September 12th, a 1079, anonymous call, came into dispatch reporting a possible 20, break-in, at Friedman's department store. The caller said a masked man with a crowbar had been spotted trying to pry open the door. Central Station verified no signal 10, alarm triggered. Officers Greg Keene and Mark Porter, 10 Ford, acknowledged. The officers, 1023'd, arrived on the scene at 3:35 and took a 50, left their car, to check the building. At 3:55, they called a 4, all clear, and requested a 29, meal break. The break was 10 Ford. At 4:45, dispatch requested a 1020, location.
Officers were apparently still 10-7, out of service, and it was assumed that they were still 29, eating. At 5 o'clock, 5:05, and 5:10, dispatch reached out again. A possible 1092 was filed, transmitter out of service. And finally, at 5:15, officers Pendleton and Carson were sent to check for Keene and Porter at their last known location. A 63 was called immediately. Officers down. Kate reread her work. She turned to a new page and wrote down Friedman's Department Store. She underlined the words twice. The store was on Decatur Street. Jimmy Lawson and Don Wesley had been in an alley off of Whitehall, which was the south-southwest leg off Five Points. Connection. Next, she tackled the autopsy. Kate made more notes, but she wasn't sure whether they would be helpful to anyone but herself. The report was very convoluted. She wasn't a doctor. The drawings were not helpful. The coroner had a shaky hand. The similarities were, both men had grit on the knees of their trousers. Both had been shot point-blank range in the center of the head. Both had eaten hamburgers within an hour of their deaths. The differences were, Mark Porter's right middle fingernail was split to the bed. Greg Keene had blood in his left ear, but Porter had none. The heels of Mark Porter's shoes were worn at an odd angle. His left shoelace was untied. His front teeth were broken posthumously as he fell face forward into the cobblestones that lined the alley. Kate studied the family statements, which mostly contained anecdotes about the dead men, stories they'd told about catching bad guys. Frankly, they came off as big fishtails, but considering all Kate had seen in the last day, she probably should take the stories at face value. Keene was a hunter. Porter hated the outdoors. They had both served in Vietnam early in the conflict. Keene was Navy, Porter was Army. Their employment records were anodyne. Neither one of them was under review, neither was up for promotion. She found it unbearably depressing that the sum total of their lives came down to these scant pieces of paper. Kate looked at the photographs again. She was better prepared for the images this time. She already knew what had happened. The shooter had been approximately 6 inches from the targets. The men were on their knees. Kate thought about that. To be forced onto your knees. To look at a gun pointing at your head. To see the finger pull the trigger. To watch the explosion of the bullet coming out of the chamber. She could not imagine the terror. Both men were married, though Keene was separated. Their wedding rings had been cataloged in the autopsy report. Both of their wives had called them good husbands, honorable men. Who had gone to their houses and knocked on their doors? Kate knew what that part felt like, at least. You knew why they were there the minute you saw them. The rest was theater. You said the line, "Yes, may I help you?" as if your brain did not know, as if your heart was not already in your throat. "What is it?" Maggie asked. Kate shook her head. She made a show of studying the photographs. Only the first few were hard to look at. The close-ups of the backs of the men's heads. Each bullet had made a perfect hole in their foreheads. The exit wounds were another story. The skulls were fractured out. Chips of white bone were stark as teeth in the bloody mass that showed brain and tissue. Those pictures were almost unreal. Kate was looking into a man's skull. But for some reason, her mind convinced her that it was fake. Maybe that was why she was able to see the scratch on the back of Mark Porter's neck. Kate held up the photo so she could better see it. Was it a fingernail scratch? One time, Kate had scratched the back of Patrick's neck in the heat of the moment. He thought it was funny the next day, but she had been mortified. Had Mark Porter's neck been scratched by his wife, or was he doing the same thing that Don Wesley had been doing to Jimmy when the murder took place? Kate felt herself shaking her head. That was too much of a coincidence. The shooter had obviously made the emergency call about the burglar behind Friedman's. Porter and Keene were lured there. As far as Kate knew, there was no directive in the manual that required you to fellate your partner after giving an all clear. There was a scale drawing of the crime scene in the back of the folder. Kate studied the diagram. The artist could teach the coroner a thing or two. The lines were steady, and the objects were clearly defined. Everything that was in a radius of 50 feet from the bodies was marked with a number on the drawing. There was a legend in the corner. Kate scanned the recovered objects, cigarette butts, pieces of broken glass, hypodermic needles, squares of tinfoil, a bent silver spoon, the keys to the cruiser parked on the street, a piece of broken fingernail. A thought occurred to Kate. Her face got so warm that she felt the need to lean her head in her hand so that Maggie would not see. If Keene and Porter had oral sex, and the result of the completion was not at the scene, then where else would it be? She flipped back to the autopsy reports. Kate folded up the pages so that Maggie wouldn't see her focusing on the separate lines that read, genitals. The word unremarkable was listed for both men. She flipped back to the sections that listed stomach contents. Both victims had partially digested hamburgers and French fries that the coroner estimated were consumed an hour before death. Nothing else was listed. Kate wasn't even sure it would be listed. Was that the sort of thing you could see inside a person's stomach?
Wait a minute, Kate said.
What?
Did your guys have anything in their stomachs?
Maggie nodded. Burgers and fries.
My guys requested a meal break right around the time we assume they were murdered, but the coroner estimates they ate dinner at least an hour before they died.
She showed Maggie the two reports.
Hamburgers and fries.
The only place they could get hamburgers that time of night is at the Golden Lady. It's a strip club off Peachtree. All the night shift guys eat there.
Connection.
Kate wrote the Golden Lady on her list.
So why did they request a meal break when they'd already eaten?
Why would they call a meal break at all?
Maggie explained.
Night shift pays double. You don't clock out for meals. Nobody checks up on you because the brass is asleep.
She nodded toward Kate's paperwork.
What else?
Were your guys lured to the scene?
Yes. There was an anonymous call reporting a break-in. No alarm.
Same with mine. Did yours request a 29?
Their last contact with dispatch was to call the scene clear and request a meal break.
Kate felt the hair go up on the back of her neck.
They were forced on their knees.
Yes.
They were shot in the foreheads?
The weapon was 6 to 8 inches away, superior angle, so the guy was standing over them holding the gun down.
That's what I have, too.
25 caliber?
25 caliber,
Kate confirmed.
Anything unusual on the diagram of the scene?
Maggie flipped a few pages in her notepad.
Cigarette butts, drug paraphernalia, a pair of ripped women's underwear.
She looked up and shrugged.
You could find that on any street in Atlanta right now.
What about the car keys?
Maggie flipped to a different page.
Ballard had them in his front left pants pocket.
My diagram has the keys 15 feet away from Mark Porter's body, Kate suggested. Maybe he had them in his hand because he was walking back to the car?
You're supposed to loop the ring around your middle finger.
Maggie pulled out her own keys and showed Kate.
That way they can't be knocked out of your hand.
Their cruiser was around the corner, a good 50 feet away.
Kate shrugged. I always take out my keys when I'm closer, but that's anecdotal.
Tell me what you see.
Maggie spread two photos in front of Kate. Ballard and Johnson face down in an alley. As with Kate's victims, the backs of their heads were blown open. Their legs were at awkward angles. Their arms were wide. The equipment on their belts was spread around. The transmitters clipped to the backs of their belts were spattered in blood.
Kate asked, "What am I missing?"
"Look closer."
Kate leaned over the pictures. She studied the bodies the same way she used to study those puzzles that asked the viewer to spot the things that are different. She went back and forth between the two. Left shoe, right shoe, right shoe. She did this all the way up to the radio transmitters.
Oh.
What about your guys?
Kate found the corresponding photos for Keene and Porter. Different angles, but roughly the same images. Two men, face down on the ground, with the backs of their heads missing. She spotted the same discrepancy Maggie had flagged.
My guys have their shoulder mics unplugged from their transmitters, too.
That doesn't happen by accident.
No,
Kate said. The jack was almost too narrow for the plug. She assumed it was designed that way so that the cord didn't easily pop out.
Kate stared at the photograph so long that her eyes burned.
Something else was bothering her. She just couldn't put her finger on it.
Look at the way their arms are spread. Maggie pointed to each picture. Every victim had his arms at the same angle.
When you arrest somebody, you make them lace together their fingers and put their hands on top of their heads.
Right. Kate knew exactly what she was talking about. Their hands must have blown apart when the bullet passed through their skulls.
Do you think the shooter forced them to request a meal break, then unplug their mics?
They didn't unplug on their own.
But the request for a meal break is a 29. These guys had a gun pointed at their heads, and instead of asking for a 29, why didn't they request a 63? Officer needs assistance. The shooter would never know the difference.
Kate answered her own question.
Unless the shooter knew the police codes.
They both thought about that. The shooter knew police codes. He knew procedure. He knew the routines.
Maggie raised her voice, calling, "Jimmy?"
She waited in vain for a response.
"Jimmy!"
She pushed herself up from the table.
"Where the hell is he?"
Kate followed Maggie through the humid kitchen, then out to the carport. Jimmy and Rick were in the metal lawn chairs under the shade. Terry Lawson and Bud Deacon sat on the hood of a brown Impala. Jet Elliott was behind the wheel, but he was obviously passed out. Chip Bixby leaned against a cord of wood. Cal Vick was beside him. They all had beer cans, even Jet. Empties littered the ground. Kate was not surprised they were all friends. They were the same type of jerks, evidence of which was likely soon forthcoming. Terry glanced up, but he was obviously in the middle of a story.
"So then what happens? Kennedy gets shot, and the only thing standing between us and that fucking commie brother of his is an Arab with a .22.
Good thing he knew how to use it."
Chip tipped his beer can. Kate could see the skin on the back of his knuckles was broken open. She suppressed a wave of nausea, not because of the violence. At the gun range, Chip had pressed against Kate's back as he showed her how to hold a gun. There weren't enough hot showers in the world to rid her body of the memory.
"No offense, sweetheart."
Terry was talking to Kate. He held a cold can to the back of his hand. His knuckles were bleeding.
"I know you people put those Kennedy bastards right up there with the Pope."
Kate bristled.
"I'm not Irish. I'm Dutch."
"I bet you are,"
Cal Vic gave a suggestive laugh that turned into a hacking cough.
Steady, Chip slapped the man on the back.
Terry picked up where he left off.
All I'm saying is people don't take power. You give it to them. Look at what's happening here. Mayor Hartsfield traded his soul for the airport and the stadium. Then Massel, that fucking kike, takes over and forces MARTA up our asses.
Chip muttered, moving Africans rapidly through Atlanta. Terry lifted his beer in agreement.
Now we get this spear chucker in the three-piece suit sitting behind the desk, and suddenly we're taking shots in the street.
He told Kate.
You weren't here 6 months ago, sweetheart. You don't know what it was like.
Fucking Spivey, Chip muttered. Edward Spivey. Kate heard the name echo in her head. Bud held up his beer can in a toast.
To Duke Abbott, best damn detective this squad ever had. He deserved better than he got.
Duke Abbott, they all intoned. Terry leaned back and knocked on the windshield.
Jet, wake up, you sad shit.
Jet stirred, but he was too far gone to do anything but roll his head to the other side.
Let him sleep it off.
Vic slurped beer from the rim of his can.
Look it, boys. I got a call back from California. Spivey's still living there. Couple of D's ran him down for me. He was on a church retreat last night. 20 people saw him.
You believe him? Bud asked. Vic shrugged.
Plane schedules won't work putting him in Atlanta around dawn and back in California by the time the detectives knocked on his door.
Them D's black or white? Chip asked. Vic shrugged again.
Sounded white, but who the hell can tell with them Hollywood types?
Queers and freaks, Bud muttered.
Look it, Spivey don't matter.
Terry slapped Bud on the shoulder.
We're gonna get this one. We'll fry him up like a chicken.
Damn straight, Vic agreed,
though he didn't seem troubled that half his detective squad was drinking in a carport rather than searching for a cop killer.
So we catch him, Bud said. So what, some lawyer gets him off, and then the next day another cop gets shot? Then another? Them's the times, boys, Vic said. Ain't none of that bullshit ever would have happened if the good guys was still in charge.
Damn straight, Chip agreed. We kept him in line.
Kept the city working, Terry added.
Kate worked to keep her expression neutral. She wondered if this was the sort of talk Leo Frank heard before the lynch mob dragged him toward the tree.
Shit.
Bud tucked his hand into the waist of his pants.
When I was coming up, there wasn't a nigger in Atlanta didn't look down when you passed by. Now they're strutting around like they own the place.
They do fucking own the place.
Terry threw his empty can into the yard next door.
What crawled up your ass, Olive Oil?
Maggie had her arms crossed. I need to talk to Jimmy.
About what?
About
nothing.
Terry talked over her.
I didn't let you bunk off roll call so you could sit around the house with your girlfriend all morning.
I'd sit around with her, Bud offered.
Chip belched. There was genial laughter from all the men but Rick Anderson. He gave Kate an apologetic look. Then he finished his beer. Jimmy threw his empty into the side yard.
Dutch.
He was looking at Kate.
That's Holland, right?
The Netherlands.
Terry answered before Kate could.
I was stationed in Amsterdam back in 45. Them gals all look like her. Tall, blonde, fucking stacked. They see the uniform, you don't even have to snap your fingers. They're already asking, how high?
He shrugged a shoulder at Kate.
No offense, doll.
None taken, she said, as if he hadn't just accused her mother and grandmother of being whores. Terry asked,
it took what, 5 days for you guys to surrender after the Nazis started dropping bombs?
Kate chewed the inside of her cheek.
There were some Dutch sailors in the Pacific.
Chip crumpled his empty can and lobbed it into the yard.
Crazy bastards. Sank more ships in a week than the entire Allied forces. Brits said it was uncouth, but fuck 'em.
Terry said,
A Dutch ship fished my brother out of the Pacific. Too bad they didn't bring him home.
He sat back on the car, seeming to reflect.
My tour in Amsterdam was at the bitter end. All over but the shouting. Krauts bombed the shit out of that city. The ordnance they used, I don't know, so fucking precise. You'd walk by a building and look through the window and there was nothing inside. No floors, no studs, no joists even. Just brick outside and an empty shell.
That wasn't from bombing. Kate was aware that her tone was terse, but she couldn't stop herself. The Nazis cut off supplies. People were starving to death. It was the hardest winter on record. They dismantled the buildings for fuel. Terry started shaking his head before she was even finished.
I was there, sweetheart. They were bombed to hell and back. Half the city was gutted.
It's called the Homer Winter. Kate hit the syllables as hard as she could. Over 20,000 people starved to death.
I read about that.
Maggie glanced nervously at Kate. Audrey Hepburn did an interview. She was there when it happened.
Audrey Hepburn's English, you dits.
Terry grabbed another beer.
You want to talk about people starving? You should have seen those camps.
Bud mumbled something Kate forced herself not to hear.
Terry said, You could see the bones underneath their skin, hollowed out eyes, teeth falling out, no hair, dicks shriveled up, tits hanging down like sandbags.
He popped the top off his beer can and threw the ring into the yard.
They were begging us for food, but you couldn't feed them. They had to have those, what do you call it, when the doctor puts the needle in your wrist?
IVs. Kate's voice was shaking. Her legs were shaking. Every part of her was shaking.
Yeah, IVs.
Terry stared at his beer can.
Me and one of my buddies, we saw this old chick. She got a hold of some bread or something. We tried to stop her, but 2 seconds after she swallowed it, she just dropped to the ground. Started having a seizure, foam coming out of her mouth, pissing herself. Doc said her stomach exploded.
Jesus, Rick mumbled. I thought Nam was bad. Bud spit on the ground.
Guadalcanal was bad. Nam was a walk in the park for you pussies.
Damn straight. Chip raised his beer in agreement.
Give me a gook over a nip any day.
Rick stood up. He went into the house. The door closed behind him. No one said anything for a few moments. Kate looked down at the broken concrete. Tears blurred her vision. She saw her grandmother on the ground clutching her stomach. She saw her mother begging for bread. Terry was a brutal man, but he'd painted too vivid an image. Kate needed to get out of here so she could collect herself. She told Maggie, We should go back to work.
Work, Terry echoed. That what you doing in there, tough gal?
He was talking to Maggie. His expression had turned dark. His tone had a knife behind it.
You following up on those shooter cases?
He grinned at the surprised look on Maggie's face.
I know what you've been up to, sweetheart. You smooth-talked Rick into getting those files. Dutch over here flashed her tits to make your brother look the other way.
Kate tasted blood on her tongue. He wasn't going to get to her. She wouldn't allow it. Terry said,
You think you found something 20 detectives can't spot?
It helps if you're sober. Maggie dodged the half-empty beer can he threw at her head. The metal hit the wall with a hard thump. We found something.
Yeah?
Terry chided.
Come on, tough gal. What'd you two geniuses find?
Maggie seemed to hesitate. Their radios were unplugged. Jimmy's head turned.
What?
All four of them. Their radios were unplugged. Terry obviously hadn't heard the information before, but he asked,
So what?
Maggie explained, In both cases, the last call each unit made was for a meal break, and then their radios were unplugged, probably so they wouldn't be able to call out. Jimmy asked,
They took a 29? On a night shift?
Terry looked at his watch.
3 hours of your morning, and that's what you came up with? They unplugged their radios before clocking out to eat?
He laughed along with Bud and Chip.
They were probably taking a shit, am I right?
Oddly, Jimmy wasn't dismissive. He told Maggie,
He didn't talk to us. The guy who took the shots, he didn't talk. He just pulled the trigger. And he slashed their tires, Terry said. Nobody else had their tires slashed, right, Columbo?
Kate watched Maggie deflate under the scrutiny. She'd been so sure of herself in the house. Kate had felt the same sense of purpose. They were doing something useful. They were trying to accomplish something.
Go back to parking tickets, sweetheart.
Terry got a fresh beer.
Another 2 or 3 days of us banging up the streets, some asshole will come in begging us to arrest the guy. You better hurry.
Bud flexed his swollen hand.
My interrogator's starting to hurt.
Good-natured chuckles followed. Maggie looked down at her feet. She kept working her jaw. She was trying to come up with something else, but there was nothing. He was dragged. Unbidden, Kate had said the words out loud. Everyone was looking at her. Mark Porter was dragged. She wanted her notes, but only for a crutch. She'd finally figured out what had been bothering her. The heels of Porter's shoes were worn on the back, not the bottom. There was a scratch on the back of his neck, probably from being grabbed. The fingernail on his right middle finger was broken. His keys were found 15 feet from his body. They all stared at her with blank looks on their faces. Maggie turned it into a story. Porter made a break for it. He was grabbed by the collar, which is why he had the scratch on his neck. Porter fell, probably with the shooter on top of him. He had his keys in his hand. The impact broke his fingernail. He was going for the car, but the shooter stopped him. Maybe Porter was knocked out, or at least dazed. The shooter dragged him back to Keene, put him on his knees, and shot them both in the head. She answered Terry's question. The shooter is adapting. He slashed the tires because the last time, someone almost got away. Jimmy sat back in his chair. He scratched his chin in thought. Terry muttered,
Leave it to a couple of broads to zero in on a broken fingernail.
The laughter was different from before. This time, the men sounded almost relieved. Maggie held on to the theory. In all three cases, they were dispatched out because of an anonymous call reporting a possible break-in. Terry shook his head.
You know how many of those calls we get a month?
3. Maggie said. I checked with dispatch this morning. That time of day, in that area, they get about 3 bogus calls a month. Jimmy wouldn't let go of his point.
He didn't talk to us, Maggie. He just came around the corner and started shooting. He was so fast I barely had time to look at him.
Maggie stared at her brother, almost begging him to understand. It's too coincidental. Maybe the shooter didn't expect you guys to be there when he turned the corner. Maybe he thought he was going to surprise you, but you surprised him. Jimmy looked down at his beer can. Kate knew what he was thinking. The shooter had been the one who was surprised. He was expecting two cops on foot, not both of them on the ground in flagrante delicto. All of the killer's plans went out the window the moment he saw them. None of which Kate could say to the assembled crowd. A car horn beeped in the street. Terry scowled.
"What's that stupid slit doing here?"
Maggie told Kate. "Go get in the car. I'll be there in a minute." Kate didn't ask questions. She walked through the carport. The sun cut into her retinas. She stared at the ground ahead of her. She tried to blink away the stars, then she tried to blink away the awful images that came into her head again. Her grandmother writhing in pain. Her mother begging for scraps of food. Terry Lawson watching the whole thing with a can of beer in his hand. Kate's chest felt tight. The muscles in her throat tensed. Tears welled into her eyes again. She had to shake this. She couldn't just break down every day. She had to be tougher. Her family was counting on her. They wanted her to be strong. Kate made herself look up. Her stomach dropped. Gail Patterson was behind the wheel of a two-door Mercury. She gave Kate a toothy grin through the open window.
"Hop in, sheep."